On March 11, 2020, the American public faced a stark reality. The toll of the novel coronavirus COVID-19 would be unavoidable for months or perhaps longer. The World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. Then President Trump went on primetime television and announced travel bans. People were dying, and the illness spread at a rapid, largely uncontrolled pace. States responded with shutdown orders. Here in Massachusetts, on March 23, 2020, Governor Baker ordered that all non-essential businesses would be shut down. The retail and restaurant industry were hit particularly hard by these orders. Restaurants were not permitted to operate in-person dining under these orders, and many failed. In Boston, one high-end coffee chain, Cafe Nero, was temporarily shuttered as a result of Governor Baker's orders, and furloughed nearly everyone in the company as a result. Come April 1st, Cafe Nero was unable to make rent. However, in all instances but one, so this is 29 out of the company's 30 locations, the chain was able to work out deals with its landlord to adjust the rental expectations and move forward with a reopening once the pandemic orders were relaxed. Negotiations went differently on Boston's famous Newbury Street. There, Cafe Nero's landlord, UMNV 205-207 Newbury LLC, was unwilling to negotiate. The landlord sent out a notice of default, and after Cafe Nero failed to cure the payment default, the landlord terminated the lease. The landlord then proceeded with eviction and collection proceedings for past due rent, and also for liquidated damages under the lease. In response, Cafe Nero contended that it was legally excused from paying rent under a principle that most of us lawyers haven't examined since law school, the doctrines of impossibility or frustration of purpose. In essence, Cafe Nero claimed that the pandemic, and in particular Governor Baker's orders, destroyed the entire purpose of the lease, thereby excusing the cafe from its rental obligations. How would the courts address the pandemic in the context of an entire industry that was ravaged by government shutdowns? This is UMNV 205-207 Newbury versus Cafe Nero Americas, Inc. Welcome to Legal Judgments, where we tackle litigation and trial strategy by analyzing and talking about real legal cases. I'm your host, Bob Stetson, a Boston-based trial lawyer at Berncoff Goodman. Today, we're looking at a case that sent shockwaves through the landlord-tenant industry, UMNV versus Cafe Nero. With me is Andrea Martin, a litigator and trial lawyer at Burns & Levinson. She is a partner and co-chair of the firm's business litigation practice. Andrea successfully represented Cafe Nero in this case. Welcome, Andrea. Thanks for joining.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the summary judgment decision in favor of your client, Cafe Nero. This decision stemmed from the landlord's motion for summary judgment. The court found that the doctrine of frustration of purpose legally excused your client from its rental obligations as a result of Governor Baker's pandemic orders, and therefore that the notice of default and termination notice was invalid. However, the court went a step further and actually entered summary judgment in your client's favor, even though you hadn't filed a motion for summary judgment on behalf of your client. This was a remarkable decision on so many different levels. And it really has reshaped and continues to reshape the landlord-tenant landscape in terms of negotiations and litigation in the wake of the pandemic. I can tell you that I was in the same session in Suffolk Superior Court recently arguing about the Cafe Nero case. And although this podcast likely won't be published for a couple of months, the Boston Globe again just this week published an article about how this case has shaped landlord-tenant negotiations. But this decision was not a foregone conclusion. and it was not necessarily consistent with the approach taken by courts in other parts of the country. So, Andrea, what did you see in this case when it first came through the door, and what was your approach?
Good question, because this client of ours goes back many years. So we had the benefit of when this case percolated up to litigation to already have a great working relationship with the client. And indeed, we had negotiated this lease in my real estate department. So we had the benefit of knowing what the purpose of this lease was. And I say purpose on not just a very narrow scale. I mean purpose in the sense that this Newbury Street location was supposed to be a big flagship location, and big in the sense more of sparkle and design, not big in square footage necessarily, but it was a big deal for Cafe Nero to get onto Newbury Street. They are a UK company and they started building out in Boston, I don't even recall exactly, but let's call it 5 or so years ago. So when this lease, you know, off of Newbury Street was negotiated, it was with the intent that Cafe Nero was going to spend a lot of money building this space out. It was going to be, you know, tourists and other people coming from other parts of America, or you know, USA, coming to Newbury Street and saying, "Ooh, Cafe Nero," you know, and taking that knowledge home to wherever they lived with an impression of Cafe Nero on Newbury Street, you know, in among all the high-end stores. And I say that because going forward, you know, skipping around, but going forward to the summary judgment papers, that was a theme we really hammered home, that this wasn't just your basic lease that two parties signed with, you know, not a lot of forethought. Indeed, the landlord knew that this was going to be a flagship. So I'll take it back to the shutdown orders. We made concerted efforts to try to reach out to this landlord. And when litigation really took off, we continued to press that in communications with the landlord that, hey, guys, remember this was going to be a big deal for us. Remember this was going to be a joint business venture. Listen, you win when we win. And in the early stages of trying to negotiate a resolution, our client at all times was not trying to, make the landlord sit around with empty pockets. It was a way to say, hey, we all know this could take off, so let's try to figure out how to take off together. And when Cafe Nero was able to reopen just minimally in June 2020, we started writing down what the sales were every week. And we put that to the landlord, and then we ultimately put that to the court to say, listen, when the government allowed us to reopen, here's how our sales ticked up. And if you let us, you know, stay in the space, they were only going to continue. So to answer your original question, you know, what made this case different or what did I see when it first came in, is that I saw something special in this landlord-tenant relationship, that it wasn't, you know, it was a Cafe Nero flagship. This was something we were invested in. We spent $1 million outfitting it. And that became a real narrative to make sure the judge took back to his office when he wrote the decision, you know, really, really colorful. I could go on and on, so I'll wait for your next question, but hopefully that answered that one.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And I want to circle back to the strategy in a moment, but during your answer, you mentioned, of course, the lease a couple of times. And I want to spend a moment on the force majeure provision in the lease. Now, in the business and legal world, I'm putting this in air quotes, force majeure describes uncontrollable events like war, labor stoppages, governmental shutdown orders. And these are typically things that are not the fault of any party, but that make it difficult, if not impossible, to carry out business. So oftentimes businesses will insert these types of clauses into a contract to address what the party's obligations are in the event of a force majeure situation. Now, from a legal perspective, because the doctrines of impossibility, frustration of purpose, because those legal concepts so closely mirror the purpose of a force majeure clause. If the contract addresses force majeure in some fashion, generally speaking, the doctrines of impossibility and frustration of purpose do not apply. Now, this lease contained a force majeure provision, but interestingly, it stated that in no event does that force majeure provision preclude the tenant from their obligation to pay rent. So, given the legal principles involved and the fact that there was a force majeure provision here, how did you get around that provision in this litigation?
Right. That was definitely a concern of ours in the summary judgment briefing. I remember specifically putting a footnote in our summary judgment briefing about the force majeure clause because we decided in our summary judgment strategy to not focus on that clause and to focus instead on, again, the real purpose of the lease to wedge ourselves into the frustration of purpose doctrine. I'd have to go back to the actual decision to recall how Judge Salinger tiptoed around that. But my recollection is that the force majeure was going to apply if there was a true shut down, you cannot do anything based on some government treaty act otherwise. But what happened with the COVID orders was a little different because what Governor Baker said was you could operate as takeout, and that wasn't in line with what Cafe Nero was designed, you know, what the purpose of the lease was for. There was another clause in the lease, and I'd have to go back to the decision to remember where Judge Salinger cited this section also, but there was another provision in the lease that mentions something along the lines of if landlord is unable to perform, then tenant shall only pay a portion related to that inability to perform. And that was another way that we shifted the court's focus on that provisional lease and away from the force majeure. Because again, as we all know, you have to read these, at least like any contract, you had to read in totality. And so I had a Cracker Jack associate, as none of us can succeed without them, Mike Deulis, and he combed through that lease for any semblance of a tenant favorable clause. So he put them all together, and we strung them throughout our papers so that while we did have a footnote and by the way, there's a force majeure clause, here's all the other places in the lease where it's anticipated that perhaps we don't have to pay 100% of the rent. And so I think the issue going back to April 2020 was when the government's shutdown order happened, it was inappropriate then for the landlord to demand full payment under the lease, no exceptions made, you know, no wiggle room whatsoever, because under the lease there had to have been some other way forward. And so I think the judge was trying to say, listen, this isn't something that either of you anticipated. Tenant, you didn't take on the risk alone, that this was a mutual risk that no one saw coming. So we had some luck that there were some other little tiny things in the lease that we just tried to really run with.
So that kind of brings back to some of the thematic elements of your briefing papers. I know earlier you mentioned the concept of flagship location and how that played into your theme. But one of the most eye-popping facts from your briefing papers, and I mentioned it in the opening, was that in 29 out of 30 instances where Cafe Nero reached out to landlords for some sort of accommodation, they were able to reach a deal, except in this case. And in your briefing papers, you mentioned quote, aggressive landlord, unwilling to even negotiate in the midst of crisis. This language is so powerful, and you know, it's so persuasive, particularly if you were going to be in front of a jury. But you know,
did I write that?
That is what you wrote. Good stuff. I am going to ask you about your process and your crackerjack associate. But when you're trying to paint the picture here, and you know, you are on a summary judgment, you're in front of a judge. It's really hard to tell whether or not you're scoring points on, you know, the sort of human interest elements. But then again, in this case, you didn't move for summary judgment, and yet the judge took the extraordinary step of granting it in your favor. So at the end of the day, I mean, what role do you think the landlord's conduct played both in this litigation as well as ultimately the judge's decision?
Right. I mean, they were, that phrase that I used, exactly, aggressive, something like that, that's exactly how they were. And it started in that the BMC, they in an eviction case. So they first simultaneously filed for possession and money damages. The possession case in traditional summary process court, and then the money damages in Suffolk Superior. And in the summary process matter for possession, it was unbelievable how aggressive they were being, even in that. And that, I remember them serving that right around the 4th of July last year. And, you know, we all as litigators know whether we want to be nice to somebody or we want to, you know, drop some papers on them before a holiday weekend. And I have specific memory in the summary process case of presenting my defense, and I served them with discovery. They refused to respond. I did a very quick and dirty motion to compel. We were in the summary process court multiple times, constantly fighting. And so that those first few months, so we're in July into August, the summary process really wasn't resolved until October. They were so needlessly aggressive in that eviction proceeding that I knew, okay, this Suffolk Superior one's going to go the same way. So I think, I hope from the papers, I tried to lay that all out for the judge so that, again, he would be tipped off that, again, this wasn't just the basic, you know, landlord tenant, you didn't pay, I didn't pay. Okay. It's like, no, I need to make this more interesting. And like I said, this client, Cafe Nero, has been a long-term client, and the principal who I worked with, I mean, I can close my eyes and tell you where I was on certain times last summer talking to him and saying, okay, here's what we're going to do. And yeah, I know, okay, this is a great location, but we can't stay in the space anymore. And I really got to know him, and I really got to know what he envisioned for the space and how upsetting this was, honestly, to him, because like it was a dream to be on Newbury Street. So when they moved for summary judgment, they didn't have to. You know, this case could have just dawdled along the regular track. And they had to, in the BLS, you have to go to court to ask to move for partial summary judgment. And we were before Judge Sanders at the time. And I in fact opposed that because I said, there's no need for you already have possession. Why do you need to have summary judgment on the money damages right away? And Judge Sanders said, oh, well, no, let's let them argue this. And I thought, well, okay, you're going to be aggressive on this too? Okay, then let's do it. So we did.
I'm sort of glad that you mentioned kind of the aggressive litigation tactics, because that's something else that I think jumped out. You know, it wasn't just from your briefing papers in particular, it wasn't just the landlord here that was taking a hard line. You know, you actually mentioned the name of the law firm in your briefing papers on this particular motion. And, you know, look, as you'd mentioned, attorneys, sometimes they can be unreasonable. And I'm not saying this happened in this particular instance, but sometimes they can be unprofessional. But there's always sort of a fine line when deciding how to address that in briefs and oral argument. And I think you handled it masterfully in this case. Now, you know, for instance, I saw recently an attorney get chastised for hurling attacks at opposing counsel during a hearing. And that attorney, I'm convinced, for that reason alone, lost the motion. So it happens. It's a fact of litigation, but it's often difficult to handle in an appropriate manner in briefings and in oral argument. How did you walk that line in this case?
So I really did try, especially at oral argument, which was in January 2021, not to personally attack counsel. That's never my goal. I really tried to focus more at that time on my client, who, again, this is actually the benefit of Zoom hearings, I suppose, is because my client's face then is on the screen the whole time. It's lovely, as opposed to sitting in the back of the gallery. And, you know, we used to all stand up and say, oh, judge, my client is in the back, you know, wave your hand a little bit, and the judge probably never sees them again. But I think my wording was necessary in the papers, but then at oral argument, again, I shifted away from that, because it didn't need to be so pointed in the argument. But it was very helpful to have my client there. I think there was that human element. I can tell you, I remember writing that affidavit. It was one of those, I needed to be in like the best space possible to get myself into his shoes, like into his mindset. You know, I didn't actually go to Cafe Nero and start sipping a latte, but I came pretty close. Like I'm both a lawyer and a patron. So I could tell you, you know, six or seven locations off the top of my head that I've been to. And I really am a big fan of the client's space and what they do. And I think it's just like a cool location. So I tried to channel him best I could, and I wrote this affidavit. It was like right around Christmas, and I had a real story to tell. You know, this is, again, I told you the company coming over here and the whole thing with Newbury Street. And I really do think Judge Salinger listened. I really do enjoy appearing before him, not just because of this decision, but just historically, I feel like every time I'm before him, he's actively listening and actively looking to counsel us, you know, with pointed questions. And this was one of those oral arguments that it was a hot day. I think I was in my office, but still on Zoom. And it was question, 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 question. And my associate was on the Zoom also. And I remember calling him afterward and saying, did I do that right? Did I answer that right? What happened? Mike, what did I say? Because when I'm in oral argument, I do not remember what I said when I said. I'm so in the zone that unless sometimes I'll read a transcript afterward and say, oh, good, that was a good point. I don't remember doing that because I'm just tunnel vision. So I remember calling Mike afterward and saying, you know, Judge Salinger asked me a question. I think I said yes. Was that right? He's like, yep, no, that was good. I said, okay, great. So it was a hot argument.
That's so funny. Well, I mean, obviously it worked out for your clients. Yeah. Now, you mentioned being a patron and the fact that Cafe Nero did start to reopen. And that's something that I think is a little bit different in this case as opposed to some of the other cases that I've seen in the wake of the pandemic. You know, after Governor Baker started to lift those orders, not only did Cafe Nero start to reopen, I saw in the briefing papers there were offers to continue paying certain rent and things of that nature. Now, ultimately, as you mentioned, Nero relinquished that space in October of 2020, presumably under the weight of the landlord's continued efforts to remove them. But the court's decision really only addressed that 3-month period from March through June when Governor Baker's orders basically addressed a complete shutdown of restaurants, sit-down restaurants. Now, I know ultimately you settled this matter, and I'm not going to ask you anything about that, but I want to ask you a hypothetical. If this case was still ongoing, given the fact that Nero ultimately relinquished the space and stopped paying rent after Governor Baker's orders, how do you think this litigation would have played out?
Is your hypothetical that we're still there, or are we? Are you saying hypothetically, if we didn't settle, what would be going on?
Exactly. Okay. Because you moved out after. So let me rephrase. Good point. Let me clarify. Nero moved out of the space in October and presumably at that point stopped paying rent. However, the doctrines of frustration of purpose and impossibility, at least as addressed in Judge Salinger's order, only addressed that time period when Governor Baker's orders were applicable from March through June. And now here you are after the governor's orders, and you're no longer operating. How does that fact play out in this litigation?
Right, that's a good question, because with Judge Salinger's order in February, he essentially said that, in so many words, we didn't have to pay rent, or we weren't in default. I guess I should say it that way. It's not that we didn't have to pay rent in April, May, half of June. It's that we weren't in default for not paying the rent. So then they were in default for terminating us. So I think at some point we would have to have, we would have had to add a counterclaim. That was going to be our first order of business after the decision, because we strategically did not, when we answered the complaint back in August, we didn't add a counterclaim at that time. We thought about it. We kicked it around. I won't, give away the whole farm, but we decided not to at that time. But we would have had a counterclaim for obviously improper termination, but then also attorney's fees for the whole mess, because the lease, like most leases, says, if you're the prevailing party and yada, yada. So we would have had a counterclaim. I don't think we would have had, we couldn't put ourselves back in the space. So it's not like, the lease was basically at that point ripped to shreds. I don't know. I honestly don't know what the rest of the litigation would have looked like. It would have come down to, okay, well, what happens with those months we didn't pay? Then we were there and operating July, August, September. We didn't pay for those, but we were willing to. So could we cure that? I think it was just going to turn into a bigger mess than it already was. So having them leave the space while not my client's dream or goal, made the possession a non-issue. And isn't possession, what is it, 9/10 of the law? Isn't that the, that's the rule, I think. So, with that piece of it solved, and I always enjoy these summary process matters, because I always want to go to the space now and say, what's going on? You find a new tenant? How's that working out for you? Hope it's a good one.
I want to ask another
hypothetical?
Yeah.
Okay.
I do, but I want to start by reading your intro.
Oh, I love this intro.
I do too. So here's the quote. There can be no clearer frustration of purpose of a lease than where the exact permissible use of the space is barred by government restriction. Here the lease states permitted use, the operation of a Cafe Nero themed cafe under tenant's trade name and for no other use or purpose. The parties operated under that lease without issue for almost 2 years. Then, on March 23rd, 2020, due to the pandemic, Governor Baker issued COVID-19 Order Number 13, which prohibited all non-essential business from operating and shut down in-person dining of any kind. The effect of the governor's order was to make the permitted use of the premises impossible under the lease. Now, that reasoning that intro paragraph, that was adopted by the court. And what I found striking was how much the court's decision focused on that use, the permitted use, a sit-down restaurant. That was frustrated. But I think the question, it's a hypothetical, the question on everyone's mind is, what are the ramifications for this decision on other industries, you know, beyond the restaurant industry?
That's a question that I get asked a lot about this decision. And I will go back to an earlier point, which you made, which was that Cafe Nero did reopen when they were able to. And I think that is a difference between them and a lot of tenants. A lot of tenants just said, I can't do anything. I'm not even going to try. So going back to your question of, what does this effect have on other industries? I think it's the same thing. So if you have any sort of space that your tenant is in, if it's completely unusable, well, then, yeah, I understand you can't go in there at all. But if there's some way to at least salvage it, I think – so we talk a lot about the ramifications of this decision on landlords and, they're so – everything's changed for landlords. I think everything changes for a little bit for tenants too, that the takeaway from Cafe Nero is not abandon your responsibilities, abandon your obligations, and, like I said, leave your landlord in a lurch. I believe what – the tenant should take away from this in terms of all sectors is, number one, try to work with your landlord, open lines of communication, do the best you can, or show how doing the best you can would be economically not feasible, and show how you're crunching the numbers, because let's be honest, most landlords care about numbers most of all. I think landlords care about numbers, and then tenants care about the vision. I'm opening this thing, and landlords are like, that's fantastic. Pay me what you're due. So, I have seen this theme play out in other, specific, one good example is this SoulCycle. I think they're still, I don't know if they're still fighting that. Have you been following that? They had I had the benefit of, talk about sort of karmic happenstance or whatever you believe in, but one of the Cafe Nero locations that we ultimately resolved, but it did start at summary process, was the one over here on Seaport Boulevard or Northern Ave or whatever the Four Point Channel one is. So they had filed summary process, the landlord, but we resolved it. But the court still made us appear on the record to report the resolution. We appear on Zoom, and when it was time for our court session, the SoulCycle eviction was going on, the one on Cambridge Street over by MGH, if you know the area. So I essentially sat video off on mute through that whole hearing. And that, it was a summary process. There's no written decision of it, but I did attach it to our papers. And the whole theme of that decision was, well, SoulCycle, if they tried to reopen, it would cost them this much money. That's why they couldn't reopen. That's what the whole purpose of the lease was. And so I think that's a theme for every tenant, is show how the math would or would not make sense for you and then for the landlord, and what can you do together. And at least if you crunch those numbers and present it to the landlord, even if the landlord's going to be super aggressive and evict you and sue you anyway, you're going to look good to the court to say, yeah, no, I understand they needed to get paid. Here's how I was going to suggest that happens. And so that sort of, I don't want to say ethical is not the right word, but showing that you're a business-minded tenant, I think applies across all sectors.
Well, it goes to show that I hate to put it in such simple terms, but it shows that you're being fair. You're putting something tangible down that shows that you're not just, like you said, sort of shirking your responsibilities here, that you're actually taking a considered and measured approach to a very difficult situation. And I think that's excellent advice, Andrea, and I really appreciate that you shared that with us today. Now, I do have one last question, and I wanted to go back to something you mentioned at the top of the podcast, which is your Cracker Jack associate, you sort of mentioned. I want to talk about your process. If you could just, you know, you mentioned remembering specifically where you were when you drafted the affidavit. How did you approach this writing assignment, and in particular, the preparing for the oral argument in this case?
So I remember reading their moving papers, and I remember reading them and saying, if you read this, you wouldn't even know that COVID had happened. You would never know there was a pandemic. You'd never know anything other than tenant did not pay. And so what I needed to do was I needed to get right away the judge reading our side and saying, wait a second, this is not your basic someone didn't pay you case. And I think your question was like about my process or whatever that means. And I try to really spend a lot of time reading everything over, taking notes, and then almost throwing it all away and waiting until I have that buzz sentence. Because without that, I don't know what I'm writing. Without that theme, you know, you go back to like eighth grade English or something. It was like, you need a theme sentence. Well, if you don't have the theme, what are you just slopping words on a page? So this was one that I procrastinated and put off writing, and I kept not writing it because I didn't know what that theme sentence was going to be. And so this is going to sound really hokey, but I started swimming again. I used to swim my whole life, and I took it back up. This is like a benefit of COVID. You can see I have wet hair today. I don't have to be anywhere. So I now...
I'm not going to take offense to that.
Now in the pool, I spend a lot of time just like letting sort of like thoughts come together and trying to spend more time, you know, going for a run, taking a walk, whatever, because that's when those theme sentences will come to me, as opposed to sitting at my desk and like reading case law. That's not where a theme sentence is not going to pop up out of case law. It's going to come while I'm swimming or running or doing something else. So this was like a really powerful summary judgment opposition to write. And my process, and then half of the other time I'm talking to Mike on the phone saying, am I crazy? This is what I'm going to argue. I had another partner of ours doing extra research. We were, you know, combing 50 states to find out, am I missing something? I hate that feeling. Am I missing something? So I need someone to do the "am missing something" piece of it, and I'll work on the theme piece of it.
I just love that. Most of the time I get my inspirational themes when I'm in the shower.
There you go.
Shower. For some reason.
That's what most people say. Most people say the shower. I don't think I take long enough showers to have that happen. It's usually I forgot to buy milk today. So,
Andrea, thank you so much for your time. Congratulations on the tremendous victory.
My pleasure.
That's our show. Check out our show notes for more information on today's case. Also, if you are involved in an interesting civil case or know about one that you think would be a good topic, reach out to me at rstetson@bg-llp.com. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. And of course, if you like what you heard, please leave us a positive review. Thanks for listening.